So my name is Nicolas Fallier. This last talk for the morning, I'm going to talk to you about DOQ a little bit and Stuxnet as well. So I'm going to try to make it short. All right. So first of all, I wanted to say that this is a work that was done by Symantec last year, by Symantec Security Response. And I was part of this team, but lots of people were involved. So here's the agenda. First of all, we're going to talk a little bit about Stuxnet, just to refresh our memories. And then we'll dive into DOQ and some of the really cool stuff that this malware actually does. And also explore a little bit the connection between Stuxnet and DOQ. So Stuxnet, here are the key facts. Again, a small refresher because it dates back to July 2010. So it's a very complicated Windows worm, Stuxnet. Uses lots of different propagation methods, seven of them actually. Four of them rely on zero-day exploits, which was sort of an anomaly in the malware world. Also exploit a known vulnerability in the RPC component of Windows, and some of the other exploits that are used leverage CMEN security issues. So you also have rootkits that were signed by digital certificates that were most likely stolen from two Taiwan-based companies. And the end goal of Stuxnet is not to just, you know, hop on from Windows machine to Windows machine. The end goal is to find a specific set of machines that have a specific Siemens software suite. And the end goal is to infect so-called programmable logic controllers that are basically computers that run factory floors. And bottom line is Stuxnet was the first known, or at least publicly known, PLC rootkit, PLC virus. The end goal is cyber sabotage, more specifically the destruction or at least damage of the two things that you see on the left and right of Ahmadinejad, which are basically a cascade of centrifuge in Natanz. So now onto DOQ. It basically all happened in October and November last year. So here's the sort of timeline. It started on October 14th. This person from Crisis, which is a security lab in Hungary, sent us an email basically telling us, oh, we found this piece of malware. It is very complicated. We named it DOQ because XYZ. And we think you might be interested because it looks very much like Stuxnet code-wise and organization-wise as well. So we hopped onto that, and the next 5 days were sort of crazy. We worked on it sort of to understand what the threat was doing and piggybacked on the Crisis paper, which was already sort of quite detailed. And so the discovery was announced on the 18th. As expected, a few hours later, the CNC that was used by the sample that we analyzed was wiped, and at the same time was taken down by the Indian hosting provider at the time. So we still had much to do on the research, so it carried on in the next weeks. And one piece of major piece that we're missing at that time was how the DOQ ended up on those infected systems that Boldy actually analyzed. And we got the answer about a week later on the 27th. It turned out to be a Word document sent in an email that contained a zero-day insight. So talk a little bit more about that later. So the key facts about DOQ, the main fact is that the code base for the drivers, for the external DLLs that loads everything, it's pretty much the same as Stuxnet, but you can see it's been recompiled from source, so you have like lots of small differences in the code, but the overall structure and functionality of the code is very, very similar. The main difference is lies in the payload itself, because the payload of DOQ, as far as we saw, is espionage, but you could have more than that. One of the main differences as well is that DOQ is highly targeted, a handful of corporations, whereas Stuxnet was spreading like crazy to reach the intended target. In the case of UQ, it's definitely not that. It's a Trojan. It does not self-replicate.
Clarification question.
Sorry.
Well, you say it's the same code. Does that mean it had all 7 spreading vectors, same stolen certs, or do you mean?
So by same code, I mean the driver that is used to load the thread is the same, and the main DLL, you know, the big DLL that contains a bunch of resources in Stuxnet, this DLL has a bunch of exports, numbered exports, so this is the exact same thing as well. But you can see like, you know, small variations.
So I'm still not clear because I don't know enough about what the DLL does. Does that mean it had the same spreading vectors or not?
Some of the components in the DLL are the same, yeah. For instance, the RPC component, which is used to execute things like on the local network, is the same.
So it's not the same code except payload, but it's similar code, except the payload's definitely different.
Yeah, but okay. Yeah, pretty much. The payload basically is part of this main DLL. This huge DLL contains like a bunch of stuff. And the outer layer of the DLL is the same in Stuxnet and in UQ.
So and you're probably going here anyway. But you know, one of the things that came up in some of the discussion about Dooku is whether it's same authors or it's just same authoring toolkit, whether it was built from the same kit or whether it really was, you know, sort of handcrafted by the same people. So are you going to be going into that analysis of that?
Of course, we don't have, you know, lots of claims to back this up because nobody came out and said, we did that. Definitely the people who wrote UQ had access to the source. That's pretty much all we can say with certainty.
But it could have been a toolkit or it could have been they're the same.
But if you consider the potential authors of Stuxnet himself, who would have the sources of Stuxnet? So.
Thanks.
Yeah. As I was saying, UQ is used to steal information from corporations, so it's not sabotage at all. The dropper used the zero day, which exploits a vulnerability in the kernel of Windows. And interestingly, one of the driver that is used by UQ to load the components when Windows boots up is also signed by a stolen digital certificates from a C-Media company, which is also Taiwan-based. There's no self-replication, but UQ has the possibility to form a command and control. Has the possibility to form a peer-to-peer network to basically pass on the components deeper in a corporate network for those machines who wouldn't necessarily have internet access. So here's a partial list of countries that were infected. In red, you see the countries that. We found out based on Symantec's telemetry. In orange are some countries that were reported by other AV vendors. Some of the countries are missing in this list, at least one of them. Mostly in Europe, Southeast Asia. You can see that Iran and Sudan are in the list. The architecture of the threat is, very similar to Stuxnet.
Quick question. Maybe you mentioned it, I missed it, but how did the Hungarians actually gain access to that. So how come Symantec doesn't see it, but you know, a small university lab gets access to this?
So NDAs have been signed, so I cannot disclose all the details, but basically the crisis lab was working with a corporation in Hungary, and this corporation happened to be infected by UQ. That's how they got hands on the sample in the first place. And then because we had done the research on Stuxnet, they sent us the sample. They also sent the sample to a bunch of other AV vendors. You guys, okay.
One other question on the geolocalization. So for Stuxnet, that was pretty sharply Iran.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's a bunch of others. Is it sharp here too, or was it more diffuse?
So as you can see on this slide, like more countries are infected, but within each country, only one or maybe two organizations were targeted. And by organizations, I mean like machine, right? So overall, we have maybe like, 20, 30 IP address that reported being infected by UQ.
But that includes Iran?
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't stand out geographically like it did for Stuxnet?
No, it doesn't, no. So just like Stuxnet, the UQ itself is controlled by a big configuration data file, which has pretty much the same format. A few things change in there. And one of the interesting field is a lifespan field. So it's usually 14 days, I think. So basically, those 14 days will instruct UQ to stay on the network, on the targeted network for 14 days, no more than will self-destruct. But the samples we have recovered, the lifespan was expanded to 30 days, which probably means that the attackers were nice and cozy there and wanted to get more stuff out. So the installation process is really convoluted. So if we assume that all the targeted organization received a Word document, maybe there are more vectors of distribution than just 0 day in a Word document. But in the case of the 0 day in the Word document, the shellcode is it all takes place in the kernel because the fonts are processed in the kernel. And you have a multi-stage loader. I encourage you to check out our paper if you want more details on that. But basically, the end goal is to load what you see on the right-hand side of the slide, the installation code that bundles three main components of Dooku, which is the DLL that I mentioned many times before, the load point driver, and the configuration data file.
So the crisis guys seem to, so just in your installation, in your slide here, mention the reliance on some form of entropy-based tests. Can you say anything about that? Do you know?
I'm not aware of that. Entropy-based what?
So the crisis guy made them mention that there was some, in the code, there was some entropy-based tests that the code was doing. But it couldn't give more specifics about what that entropy-based test was. Is that, does it ring a bell to you?
No, it does not.
Okay.
It does not. There are many tests in the code, especially for the time frame, like both in the driver and in the DLL, to make sure that, for instance, if you run the Word document on your machine right now with an unpatched Word, the UQ will not install. Like the time frame was like 2 days, and then the DLL has a different lifespan counter, like 30 days or 14 days. But as far as entropy is concerned, I haven't seen something like that. So the signed driver, just quick note to say that it was revoked as soon as we found it because it was a very signed certificate, so easy for Symantec to do any revocation on this side. And this was like the core of UQ, the command and control module, which was completely overkill in the case of this threat. So the whole communication between infected hosts and the command and control servers takes place over TCP/AT, which is usually HTTP, or TCP/443, which is not necessarily HTTPS. Basically, they use like some tricks. The two first D words of the stream are used to indicate to the server, to tell the server, okay, this is not HTTPS, this is actually UQ. And so the command and control server, for instance, the one in India, would reply appropriately and start, you know, UQ communication. So they use a very simple steganography in the case of HTTP by prepending blank JPEG files in all communication. The protocol itself is a TCP-like protocol. So they support fragmentation, sequence numbers, reordering of the packets, removing the duplicates, and all that stuff. Everything is encrypted using AES. The key is fixed, which implies that the command and control servers that these guys operate have a list of keys for each of the targeted organization, and it makes sense because of the strong correlation between the orgs and the CNCs. And you also have a one or two layers of compression, LZO, and some custom compression layers. Yeah.
So the protocol you say that's TCP-like, that's on top of HTTP?
That's the protocol that's tunneled inside.
Tunneled over HTTP, which is over TCP.
Yeah.
So there's two reliable protocols going on.
Yeah. And actually you have four of them because HTTP and HTTPS are the ones used when a UQ infected machine communicates externally. But once inside a corporate network, if a host wants to communicate with another host inside the same network, they can do that over the pipes, which basically removes all this header and the steganography stuff. It just goes away. Or they can do it over HTTPS, but the real HTTPS this time, not some fake HTTPS. So overall, you have four methods of communication.
Okay. And you mentioned the fixed key, which had me wondering in general about authentication. Are you going to talk about authentication of command and control and the like?
What do you mean by authentication?
So if an infection receives a command, does it authenticate it? Like look for a public key signature,
It? There's nothing of such. No.
Really?
No.
Yeah. Weird. Okay.
Well, if you consider that the threat is highly targeted, there's not a big need for that.
It just seems that if you're building such a dicey, provocative malware, you wouldn't want your opponent to take it over.
I totally understand your point.
And or to some frame of the, you, somebody, a third party.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the big botnets out there, for instance, Sality, does exactly that. Everything is authenticated using an RSA key, which is embedded in the binary. In that case, I understand, because the level of sophistication, they should have done something like that. They could have done it. They didn't go for it. And some of the elements, you know, point that, yeah, maybe was not really necessary.
Okay. And finally, a point of order. We have 5 more minutes that we need to stop this.
Okay.
Session.
Yeah, I'm going to speed it up. So the payloads we've seen so far were not super cool. Mainly, it's InfoSphere components, and that's why we're saying that UQ does not do any sabotage like Stuxnet was doing. So InfoSphere component to steal like screenshots, keystrokes, files, and so on. They also had a small reconnaissance module that was uploaded automatically when a client was just connecting to the server. And they had this lifespan expansion module. So these are the only 3 components that we've seen. They can be saved on disk as well. So we've tried to recover. We've contacted a bunch of organizations that had been impacted by DQ, and we asked them, okay, maybe you have those specific encrypted files on your disk with this very specific file name. If you have them, please send them to us, because they might be modules that we haven't seen so far, but we're unsuccessful at these attempts. And some of the weird stuff. So I was mentioning that the Word document uses a TTF 0-day. It's a 1-byte override in the kernel, which they managed to exploit successfully. So some really funny stuff is that the font file claims to be Dexter regular, and the publisher, they use Showtime Inc. And you know that Dexter is this, you know, super famous TV show by this guy who kills other people. So, you know, maybe there's some irony there, especially that the font file only has a bunch of characters defined. So you can see only 2 of them. So, yeah, they had fun writing this code. This is an interesting one. So the link with the STARS virus, which we never really recovered officially. So it happened in April 2011, so 6 months before DQ broke in the news. Some Iranian officials said that they were hit by a virus. They did not disclose the sample, but they named the virus STARS. And inside one of the Keylogger components of DQ, you have a JPEG file that is embedded that prepends basically an executable file, again, some simple steganography. And this is the file in question. I have no idea why these authors decided to include the picture of a galaxy taken by the Hubble telescope, but that's what they did. And maybe that's the reason why the Iranian called the virus STARS, if it's this virus indeed. Some of the dates coincide in the sense that we have found DQ in 2 organizations in Iran, and it seemed that the timestamps actually matched April 2011 at the time, so there might be a connection there. And finally, the command and control module inside of DQ may have been coded by a different team, by a team that did not code, you know, the outer layer of the thread, because DQ is entirely C++, like Stuxnet is. The command control module is not. It's probably C. C with like OOP features. So to have, you know, some of the benefits of OOP without the hassle of the C++. So that's really weird code. If you look at the code, you will see that it's really strange, especially how all the objects communicate with each other. A hassle reverse. They use method calls and queues, event callbacks. Very difficult to follow. And it doesn't look like the usual code, C++ or C. There are many more oddities in the code as well. I encourage you to check the blogs and paper if you want to know more. So I'm just going to conclude fast. Duke U, I said it many times, share many similarities with Stuxnet, but the end goal is completely different. In both cases, it seems the resources required to pull such a threat, especially not just the threat itself, but the organization and the fact that they target, you know, these corporations, and the fact that they have so many CNCs, and the fact that these CNCs are just proxies to more proxies to more proxies. It's very extremely professional. It raises many issues, including the attribution issues, which we faced with Stuxnet. We faced them with Duke U as well. But the level of sophistication remains singular, so we're probably not going to see that every week or every month, not even every year, which is good. One last thing, the attackers have not gone away. We have recovered samples of Duke U timestamped as late as February 2012. And it all happened in October 2011. So these guys are in no way concerned by what the press says, what the AV companies say. They just do their stuff and don't really care. So check out the papers, and thank you for listening. So if you have questions.
We have time for one or two questions if people want to ask further.
So can you say anything about your last bullet here with the new Duke U binary?
It was a regular, one of the regular binary, nothing major in them, just the compile timestamp changed. That's it.
Is that being acquired through the same vector as the original by the researchers? The researchers are getting it the same way they got the original, or they're new?
In the case of this sample?
Yeah.
I don't know. Because I don't know in the case of this sample.
So can you go back to your installation slide, please? Thanks. So you said there was a reliance on some kernel module or something else? So what is required for the exploit to work?
The only thing that is required is you have a vulnerable version of Word, of course, mm-hmm. and that you open the Word document in the very, very short time frame that is specified in the threat. So I can tell you that for the Word document that we recovered, the time frame was 2 days, somewhere in July. Wow. So it means if you open the file, you're supposed to open it on Monday, you open it on Wednesday, then nothing will happen. Fine.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.